like what they say. The red juice tooth, all of it. The dog nose really does look like a dog nose. The ear pick, my goodness. You can, yeah. Very, very aptly named.
There are a lot of mushrooms out there that are delicious. And then there are some that just look, you look at them and you go, not eating that. Well, that's our student phenology for this week. As always, if you have observations you'd like to share, please send them along. We'd love to hear from you. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org.
Coming up in just a few moments, we'll have the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Edward Jones Financial Advisor Christina Gallas, helping individuals and business owners reach their financial goals. More information at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Where support for KAXE comes from the Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org.
Gradually clearing skies today, highs in the upper 70s, northwest winds around 5 to 10. Cloudy tonight with lows 51 to 56, and sunny tomorrow, highs 78 to 82.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. A lit firework collided with a 13-year-old boy's chest while he held it, which killed him on Friday in Natowash. The Star Tribune reports the incident was confirmed by the Mahnomen County Sheriff's Office. Witnesses identified the child as Michael Turner. Authorities say he pointed a large firework away from himself, but it shot through the bottom of the tube. Officers arrived at the 300 block of New Circle Drive shortly after 11 p.m., and Turner wasn't breathing and lacked a pulse. He was pronounced dead at the scene. The Natowash Community Council invited people to the Drum Hall on Sunday to support each other following the event. The White Earth Nation also opened two behavioral health buildings on Saturday. Two people have died as the result of a two-vehicle head-on collision on Friday afternoon in rural Itasca County, south of Cohasset. The crash involved four people, two in a minivan and two in a pickup truck, and occurred at the intersection of County Highways 62 and 63. The Itasca County Sheriff's Office reports an elderly woman was ejected from a minivan and the elderly male driver was found pinned inside. Life-saving efforts were attempted on the woman but were unsuccessful. The man was airlifted to a Duluth hospital in critical condition but later died. A man and woman in the pickup truck suffered non-life-threatening injuries and were treated at Grand Itasca Hospital in Grand Rapids. A preliminary investigation indicates the van may have turned into the path of the oncoming pickup truck. The investigation is ongoing and those involved have not yet been identified by the sheriff's office. A weekend fire has destroyed LSC Environmental Products near Floodwood. Friends of the Northland Firewire reports that on Friday night around 10:30, the Floodwood Fire Department was dispatched to the plant. They encountered an 18,000-gallon propane tank with 40-foot flames that destroyed a shed and was spreading to the main facility. Firefighters had extinguished the fire early Saturday morning, but later that morning, crews from several departments were dispatched to the plant, which was engulfed in flames and heavy smoke. The plant roof collapsed. Floodwood crews were called back Sunday afternoon when a huge black smoke column appeared. According to its website, the business produces spray-applied environmental coatings used for soil stabilization, revegetation, remediation, and reclamation. July 3rd marks 5 years since the disappearance of Jamie Lyle Lucas in rural Outing. Lucas fled on foot from authorities after an attempted traffic stop in the Eastburn Road area in Crooked Lake Township on July 3rd, 2020. Lucas is described as a white male, 6 feet 4 inches tall, weighing 170 pounds. He would now be 43 years old. He was wearing a white t-shirt with blue jeans, a green bandana with a baseball hat, and boots. Anyone with information about Lucas's whereabouts is encouraged to contact the Cass County Sheriff's Office. Detours are going into effect this week in Wadena as the Minnesota Department of Transportation completes road work. As of Monday, Highway 71 is closed to through traffic between Highway 10 and Juniper Avenue while work is done on underground utilities and the road is reconstructed. A pedestrian tunnel at the old hospital will be removed and sidewalks will be updated. Tuesday, a portion of Highway 10 will be closed to through traffic between Highway 71 and Ottertail County Road. There, poor soils will be replaced, drainage pipes will be installed, and the road will be constructed. Detours are expected to be in place through late August. Access for those who live, work, or visit areas near the project will be open, but motorists may need to use side streets or alleys. There are also some shorter road closures to be aware of in St. Louis County. The CN Railroad will be completing work on two separate railroad crossings soon. Each will result in a two-day road closure. The first closure will be on Maple Grove Road just east of Munger Shaw Road on Thursday and Friday. The second closure will be on the St. Louis River Road just west of Eichelow Road on Monday and Tuesday, July 14th and 15th. In both instances, the roads will be closed at 6 a.m. on the first day and reopened by the end of the second day. Due to the relative briefness of the closings, the county says no detour routes are being established. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, phonology, and morning show teams. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
You can hear the latest edition of the Up North Report today at 5:30 during All Things Considered here on KAXE. Morning, it is 7:06. I'm Jennifer Barr sitting in for Heidi Holton today with John Latimer.
Support comes from Cass Soil and Water Conservation District, offering a variety of native plant and seed mixes for different growing conditions to assist creating stable shorelines and habitat for beneficial insects and birds. Online ordering is now open to pick up on Friday, August 1st. Info at casswcd.org.
We also thank Klocko Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer as well as modern classics for 7 years now. Their taproom is open Monday through Saturday, noon to 8, Sunday, noon to 6. More info at klockobrewing.com. Coming up at about 7:20, we'll have John Latimer's latest phonology report. Right now, more from Morning Edition here on KAXE.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Texas Governor Greg Abbott says state agencies will not stop recovery and rescue operations until every missing person is found. This after more than 100 people are known to have died after flash flooding in central Texas, most of them in Kerr County. The floodwaters rose so fast that the National Weather Service posted what it says was an exceedingly rare flash flood emergency. And between 4 and 6 a.m. on July 4th, with up to a foot of rain falling, the Guadalupe River surged with water levels as high as 30 feet. But we're still wondering why those warnings evidently didn't get to the people who needed to hear them. Tom DiLiberto is a meteorologist and former public affairs specialist with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He's now with the nonprofit news organization Climate Central, so we're going to put the question to him, and he's on the line with us now. Good morning, Mr. DiLiberto. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I realize we've been asking this since this whole tragedy happened, but I'd love to get your take on what caused this huge surge in the river. And I want to be clear, you haven't worked in Texas, but from what you've read and know, what were the factors that made this particular event so dangerous?
Yeah, sure. This is a nightmarish scenario for any meteorologist, especially those in the Hill Country, where you have very slow-moving thunderstorms taking advantage of a very, very wet atmosphere and dropping an absolute ton of rainfall, basically near the headwaters or upriver along the river, that basically then would flow down that river, but happening not only on a holiday weekend, but happening overnight in a rural area where it's difficult to get the word out. It was basically a confluence of factors, also including the fact that it took advantage of a warmer than average Gulf of Mexico. And we know that extreme precipitation events like this are also influenced by climate change.
How much advance warning would the National Weather Service have gotten? I'm just asking, like, what are the tools? What's the time frame in which you would be able to issue an emergency warning for something like this?
So it's incredibly difficult to forecast the amount of rainfall that fell during this storm. Over 15 inches of rain fell in certain places. But what can happen ahead of time is you can say a broad area is expecting to see 4 to 7 inches of rain. And then while the event is actually occurring, you can kind of pinpoint exactly where that extreme heavy rainfall is occurring. So there were alerts 24 hours ahead of time, and then of just broader risks to floods. And then as the event started taking place, I believe the first flash flood warning came out a little after midnight, I think 1 a.m. that day. So you can kind of make these forecasts a little bit more specific as you move through. But the problem is a forecast is only as good, a watch is only as good, a warning is only as good as people's ability to actually get it, to receive it, and to understand what to do when they actually do get it.
Yeah, to that end, you know, a lot of people, including Democratic Congressman Joaquin Castro, on this program yesterday, have called for an investigation into the warnings that preceded these floods. So in general, how should this have worked?
Right. So what happened in this case was that when the Weather Service issued flash flood warnings at 1 a.m. and then when they issued updates and when they issued a flash flood emergency, it basically set into motion an automated system that would send out those messages to your phone that make those loud noises. But again, it's happening overnight. People don't necessarily receive them at the time that they're sent. And also in rural areas, it's hard to get. So other places around the country who are prone to flash flooding have put in other sorts of methods to warn their residents before a flash flood. That could include things like sirens. We know about tornado sirens. These are basically flash flood sirens. They're louder. They can get to people in rural areas in these near these creeks and in these ravines. And there are other methods where you can basically make sure that you can kind of reach out, but especially for these rural areas where it's difficult to reach everybody in time, sirens can provide a very useful way of getting the word out quickly that hopefully can awaken people to the risk even during the overnight hours.
So I want to mention you're one of the hundreds of NOAA employees who were laid off in February. The National Weather Service is part of NOAA. Given your expertise, if you were advising the government on where to look for areas of improvement, what would you suggest?
You know, I think the weather forecasts, while not perfect, they were good enough to be able to communicate necessarily the risk. But I think what the issue what we saw here was a breakdown in understanding and communication between the weather forecasts and then the folks on the ground. Whenever you have an event like this with such a horrible loss of life, it's a failure. It's a failure. But importantly, it's a system failure. I'm not pointing fingers at any individual person. It is a system failure. And that involves not only making the forecast, the ability to communicate the forecast, but also the understanding on the ground with the county officials, emergency managers, state-level officials, to put in action plans that they have. So I think the key thing here in order to improve the situations, not only in Texas, but in flash flood-prone places across the entire country, is to make sure that the National Weather Service has the staff needed to basically create and form those relationships with local officials so that the next time this happens, there's a clear line of communication between the Weather Service and elsewhere.
We have to leave it there for now. That's Tom DiLiberto. He's a meteorologist. He's formerly with NOAA. He's now with Climate Central. Thank you.
Thanks.
Investors got an unwelcome reminder this week that President Trump still likes tariffs.
Stocks tumbled Monday after the president threatened to impose stiff new import taxes on more than a dozen countries, including Japan and South Korea. Trump pushed back the effective date of those tariffs, however, until August 1st. And if recent history is a guide, he could change course before that. In the meantime, though, U.S. importers are facing several more weeks of tariff limbo.
NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now to discuss all this. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Lily.
So, Scott, it feels like tariffs, no tariffs, tariffs, no tariffs. A little bit like Groundhog's Day here. What's going on?
Yeah. Well, Trump posted letters on social media yesterday threatening to slap 25% tariffs on everything the U.S. imports from Japan and South Korea, along with even higher rates on goods from other smaller trading partners. Those tariff rates are similar to the ones Trump called for back in April, using a formula based on the U.S. trade deficit with each country. Of course, back in April, he backed down after a sharp sell-off in the stock market. At the time, the president said he was suspending the highest tariffs for 90 days to allow time to make new trade deals. Now, that 90-day window closes tomorrow, and so far not a lot of new deals have been struck. So once again, Trump is pushing back the effective date for another 3.5 weeks. So who knows what the real tariff rate will ultimately be? For now, the waiting game continues.
So what does that mean for trading partners or for U.S. businesses and consumers?
For trading partners, they might be wondering just how serious Trump is, since he keeps moving the goalposts. Mm-hmm. The two countries that have struck trade deals, the UK and Vietnam, did not get any real tariff relief from the United States. For businesses that depend on imports or consumers who, say, want to buy a Japanese car or a Korean appliance, this just means more uncertainty. Should they race to buy now before the tariffs go up? Should they wait to see if tariffs will be lower down the road? It's hard to make a decision when the rules keep changing. And Scott Linsicum, who is a trade expert at the Libertarian Cato Institute, says that's where we are right now.
We have no idea what tariffs will be in August. We have no idea what they'll be next year. And that is a brutal investment environment for either importers or individuals looking to invest in the United States.
A report from the Institute for Supply Management last week said this tariff limbo is really weighing on the U.S. factory sector, which, by the way, is supposed to be the beneficiary of the president's trade war. As one factory manager quoted in the report put it, customers do not want to make commitments in the wake of massive tariff uncertainty.
Okay, and meanwhile, the government continues to collect tens of billions of dollars in tariff revenue. How's that going?
So far this year, the government's collected close to $100 billion in tariffs. More than two-thirds of that has come in just since April, when Trump announced his worldwide import taxes. Linsicum says foreign companies might absorb some of that tariff expense, but most of the tax is going to fall on families and businesses here in the United States.
Barring a really radical departure from the traditional economics, it means that somebody in America is paying all of those new taxes.
And even though the higher tariffs have been pushed back until at least August 1st, the average tax on imports today is five or six times what it was before Trump returned to the White House and launched this new trade war.
NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
Tariffs came up at the annual meeting of BRICS over the weekend. That stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The group of emerging economies, which actually includes more countries now, has challenged what it sees as U.S. dominance in global affairs. Brazil's President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva called for less global confrontation, but that didn't go over well with President Trump. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
The BRICS 31-page summit statement covered a lot of international territory and plenty of criticism. Among those, it called out the, quote, indiscriminate rising of tariffs, but stopped short of directly naming the U.S. or Trump. That toned-down declaration by BRICS leaders and diplomats apparently wasn't cautious enough, says Oliver Stunkel with Brazil's FGV University.
They probably believed that they could fly below the radar of Trump as long as they didn't mention the United States, but that clearly failed.
Trump followed with a terse post on social media threatening to slap an additional 10% tariff on, quote, any country aligning themselves with the anti-American policies of BRICS. Founding member South Africa entered into the Trump fray. Its president said the powerful can't seek vengeance against, quote, those who are seeking to do good in the world. Trump announced 30% tariffs on South African goods starting August 1st. There had been worries that the BRICS group was losing relevance as it continued to expand beyond its original members. Consensus among the divergent countries, now including Indonesia and several Middle Eastern nations, has been difficult. However, the group did manage to dial down criticism of its own. Russia's Vladimir Putin faced no rebuke over the war in Ukraine, and Iran was called out not for its nuclear program, but as a victim of Israeli airstrikes. Brazil's president tried to end on a positive note and not let Trump's tariff threats draw too much focus.
É conjunto de países querendo criar outro jeito de organizar o mundo.
We are a group wanting to create another way, said Lula, with more focus on human relations and development and not confrontation. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
This is NPR News.
It is 7:19. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr sitting in for Heidi Holton today with John Latimer.
We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net.
Taking a look at our current temperatures, 56 in Hibbing is the cool spot, 64 in Brainerd, our warm spot. currently 61 in Grand Rapids, 63 in Park Rapids, and 60 in Bemidji. We'll have gradually clearing skies today, highs in the upper 70s, northwest winds 5 to 10, partly cloudy tonight, lows 51 to 56, and sunny tomorrow. Looks like a good day, highs 78 to 82, and looking ahead to Thursday, mostly sunny, a bit warmer, highs 81 to 85, slight chance of showers in the afternoon.
Good day to go to the lake.
Yeah.
And that was our question of the week. What exactly? What do you like about the water?
What do you like to do in the water, on the water?
Near the water, with water. I like to mix water with my whiskey.
You can text us your thoughts, 218-326-1234.
Programming is supported by Grand Dental Center, where doctors Lisa Johnson, Leanna McBride, and their staff provide full-service family dental care for patients of all ages in Grand Rapids and surrounding communities. More information at granddentalcenter.com.
Coming up, we'll have John's latest phenology report.
It's time for the Phenology Show. Phenology is the rhythmic biological nature of events as they relate to climate. And we are moving into the peak of summer. And that usually involves the peak of summer. It's sort of symboled, brought to consciousness, I guess, by the blooming of the black-eyed Susans and the tall woodland sunflower, which hasn't begun to bloom. The black-eyed Susan is blooming and probably approaching its first peak of bloom. But the tall woodland sunflowers, not yet. Dallas Hudson over in Akeley says that that's happening over there. What else tells me that summer is here? Ripening berries. And the first blueberries are ripening outside in the natural world. The dwarf raspberries are ripe, and I ate some yesterday. Red raspberries are just beginning to ripen. There are a couple of ripe raspberries in the area, and the juneberries are starting to ripen. And with the juneberries, remember, you've got to get after them when they're ripe, because the birds are definitely watching them and eating them the moment they become ripe. And juneberries are quite delicious, so I have mine covered in netting so that the birds can't get at them, although the chipmunks will climb up under the netting, chew their way in, and have their way with the juneberries. That doesn't sit well with me, and I put my dog out there and let her have her opportunities to chastise the chipmunks. And chastise she does. If you're a dog and you chastise chipmunks, it's hard on the chipmunks. They don't often survive. But there are lots of them, so I guess it's a fair trade. It's all worth it when it comes to juneberries. Other plants that I'm seeing in bloom, just the flowers now, just looking at flowers, the tall meadow rue. This is, you're going to see a cloud of kind of creamy white standing pretty much above most of the surrounding vegetation. Tall meadow rue, if you get up and look at it, there'll be clusters of these little white flowers, and they have little dangly bits. They always remind me of sort of the bits of cut glass that you see hanging down from a chandelier. There are lots of little dangly parts on the tall meadow rue flowers. Meadow sweet, which grows along the lake edge, is just now putting out flower buds. I haven't seen any blooms yet, but the flower buds are out. Swamp milkweed began to bloom this past week. That was about a day early. Fringed loosestrife is blooming, and that's about 3 days early. Fringed loosestrife, if you come across it, typically it's going to be five petaled flowers about the size of a quarter, half to three quarters of an inch across. And the edges of the flower petals are kind of rough and fringed. So fringed loosestrife. Now, Dallas over in Akeley came across the ragged fringed orchid, which is a tall white orchid, typically growing where I have seen it is growing in thick grass. And here stands this beautiful orchid all by itself. And if you come across this orchid, it has a white flower, and the flower looks really, really fringed. I mean, it's there isn't much of a flower there. There's mostly these stringy little parts that sort of form in the shape of a flower. The fringed orchid is, of course, an orchid, and it is not common. But if you're out looking and you come across some fringed loosestrife, it may occur to you to look for the fringed orchid. They're both out there right now in bloom. I saw my first early goldenrod beginning to bloom this past Saturday, and that was 3 days early. Spikenard is blooming, and that's 4 days early. Clasping leaf dogbane is blooming, and that one is 6 days early. Fireweed is blooming, and that one was 2 days late. Down along the shore of Crooked Lake, and probably in a lake near you, there's a little yellow flower called common bladderwort, and it's going to stand 3 to maybe 6 inches above the water surface. It has these beautiful little yellow flowers that are quite ornate. But the real trick of the bladderwort is that down below it has these bladders that sort of help float the plant, and they also are adept at capturing and eating some of the microorganisms that are floating around in the lake, and an occasional insect, I've been told. The Canada thistle, the first of the thistles, has begun to bloom. Canada thistle is the one that is more... So if you walk up to the thistle plant in your yard and you look at it, if the stem is smooth, that is without prickers on it, that is probably Canada thistle. If it has a stem that is covered in prickers just the way the leaves are, that's probably bull thistle. If you're looking at the flower itself, the Canada thistle, my wife is an artist, and so she beats into me all these notions about colors. I would say that the Canada thistle is more to the blue side of the purple spectrum, and the bull thistle is more to the red side of the purple spectrum. Both are purple flowers, but one is a bit more blue than the other. And the other, the Canada thistle, is a bit to the blue side. The bull thistle's a bit to the red side. So check out the thistles. They're probably, the Canada thistles surely are blooming in your neighborhood. If I didn't mention it, blueberries are beginning to come ripe. One of the flowers that I'm seeing really a lot of right now is a plant called sulfur cinquefoil. And sulfur cinquefoil, there are four or five different kinds of cinquefoils here in northern Minnesota. And the sulfur cinquefoil grows up on high ground. It is a tall plant, probably 12 to maybe 15 inches tall. It has this lovely, soft, buttery yellow kind of a color of the flower. The flower is the palest yellow. Think of a stick of butter and then maybe lighten it up a shade. There, it is yellow, but it is the softest, palest yellow you'll ever see. Sulfur cinquefoil, and it is blooming in profusion right now around my house. White and yellow sweet clover are both in bloom. The white sweet clover began to bloom last week around the end of June. Typically, that happens around the average date for white sweet clover first sightings is the 26th of June. Lots of hedge bindweed blooming right now. The hedge bindweed is that big white trumpet of a flower that when you see it, you're going to say, oh, look, the morning glories are blooming. We don't have morning glories this far north. We have hedge bindweed. The difference is in the leaf. Really, the flower is almost identical. But the leaf of the hedge bindweed looks like a spear point or an arrowhead point. And the leaf of the morning glory is heart-shaped. So big difference, pretty easy to see. Let's see, what else have I been noticing? Well, basswood is in bloom. It's a lovely, lovely smell. If you are a beekeeper, you already know about basswood honey. It has its own particular odor. I would recommend, if you want a real experience, go out and pick a bunch of basswood flowers off of a basswood near you. Pale yellow flowers, big clusters. Pick a bunch of those, set them out, and let them dry. And once they're dry, kind of crinkly, crusty dry, crumple them up and make a tea, and you will be amazed at how beautiful it smells and how lovely it tastes. Basswood tea is, well, really quite nice, sometimes called linden tea because the basswood is known as a linden out in Europe. pardon me. Smooth and staghorn sumac are both at their peak of bloom right now. So if you are looking at sumac in your neighborhood, you're probably looking at a cluster of sort of greenish looking flowers. They're pale, pale yellow, but lots of green. And they are covered in full open flowers right now, both of the sumacs up here. No poison sumac this far north, so don't worry about that. But the smooth and the staghorn sumac are out there. Staghorn sumac, the difference between them is just the fuzz, the hairs that grow on the staghorn sumac that are absent from the smooth sumac. The staghorn gets its name because it's kind of like a deer's antler in velvet. It's covered in this velvety fuzz. So you can just look at the sumac in your yard and know right away whether it's smooth or staghorn. Mountain maples, these shrubs, are just freighted with seeds right now. Not yet ready to fall, but certainly lots and lots of seeds on the mountain maples. The American mountain ash is covered in fruit, though they are still green. Same is true of nanny berry, pin cherry, choke cherry. All of those plants are really heavily freighted with fruit this year. And they will be ripening in the next weeks. Northern holly is done flowering and has set fruits. The fruits are just these tiny little green dots right now. It'll be a while before they become sort of the edible fruit that that the birds like. Again, northern holly, one of those plants that produces a fruit that is not really palatable. I've tried them at different times during the year, and they are just bitter. There's nothing to recommend them. Among the insects, quite a listing of insects. The butterflies are just thick right now. The Atlantis fritillary, the viceroy, the monarch, the tiger swallowtail, the white admiral, the red admiral, northern pearly eye, and a dozen of the little checker spots that are so hard to identify, Harris and others. I have a big patch of spreading dogbane that is at its peak of bloom. There are thousands of flowers in this clump. And it is just absolutely alive with butterflies of every color and description at this time of year. So check out the flowers around your house. There are lots and lots of different butterflies. This is the peak season for butterflies. It's also the peak season for dragonflies. And just a short hike around my place, I found the widow skimmer. This is a black and clear wing with a white tail. The common white tail, which has no pattern on its wings, but has a broad white tail. The 12-spotted skimmer, this one has, on each wing, it has three or four dark or light spots. The females have no white on their wings. They simply have these dark alternating spots on their wings. But the males have white or black and both on their wings, the 12-spotted skimmers. Eastern pond hawks, my friend Fred Anthony sent me a picture of a female eastern pond hawk. He lives on the Mississippi River, just west of Grand Rapids. And my friend Dallas Hudson over in Akeley also has lots of pond hawks. And Fred's question to me was, are they common? And I said, it depends on where you are. For instance, I never see pond hawks at my house. But I go to Dallas's house, and they are probably the most common butterfly or dragonfly in his yard. So lots and lots and lots of the pond hawks, if you're in the right spot. And the interesting thing about them is that the female is uniformly green from the head to the tail, and the male is uniformly sky blue from the head to the tail. There's a little bit of black here and there on them, but basically the overall color is on the female, bright green, on the male, sky blue, and they are absolutely gorgeous. And like so many of the different dragonflies that are out there, they are really worth the time to kind of get a close look at them. Another one that's out there right now and is one of my favorites is a calico pennant. And the calico pennant male has a black tail, and on the tail are four red hearts. So on the abdomen of the calico pennant, you're going to see black, and then right in the middle, probably, I don't know, segments 3 through 7 or something like that, there are going to be four red hearts in a row right down the top of that tail, and they are stunning. Calico pennants. The females aren't nearly as eye-catching, but they are lovely, and there are lots of them out there. Note about the mosquitoes, that they are increasing, but nowhere near alarming. I have no fear of the mosquitoes yet. They are nothing compared to some years. Deer flies are out and seeking blood. I have donated to them, but I have also... I've been bitten maybe 3 or 4 times, and I probably killed a dozen so far this year. And I will continue to try to wipe out the entire deer fly population, but I will have help. The spiders are out there capturing deer flies, and dragonflies are eating deer flies. And I can clearly remember one day a big blue darner landing on my wrist with a deer fly in its legs and munching on it while I stood stock still and watched. It ate the entire deer fly while it sat there on my wrist, and I couldn't have been happier. It was a feast that I didn't mind not sharing, but it was certainly one that I enjoyed watching the deer fly get eaten. They are, they're quick, and their bite is painful. I was walking into the house just this last week. I had my hands full. Both hands struggling to get the door open. There's one biting me in the neck. I'm like, okay, get inside, set things down. I get my load dropped, and the deer fly leaves my neck and flies over to the window, and I chased it to the window and squished it and had the pleasure of seeing my blood smeared on the glass. Oh, I do not like deer flies. I did have, on the 3rd of July, and Dallas had a note, a similar note, in Akeley on the 4th of July, and that was an incredible number of lightning bugs. And they have been in decline. It has been kind of hard to get out and see them, but on that particular night, there were a lot of them out, and I was just marveling. I stood outside for probably 10 minutes and watched them flash here and there, some very close, some further away. Lovely display. I've told this story a number of times, but I know that there are always people who are new listeners and maybe haven't heard this before. or there are people who have heard the story and forgotten it, but there are two major families of fireflies. There is the Photinus genus, and then there is the Photurus genus. And in these two genuses, there are there is a competition. The Photinus fireflies are protected by their diet. They eat things that make them distasteful to birds. And so the birds avoid eating them because they don't taste good. The Photurus doesn't have this chemical defense, but the Photurus female will sit on a branch and flash the patterns of the Photinus firefly. She can mimic the pattern of the Photinus firefly, and typically, if you're watching fireflies, the females find a spot in the open where they can sit and flash, and their pattern is to flash a certain series of flashes in a certain sequence, and that attracts the male of that species. Well, the Photurus females copy the Photinus females' pattern and attract a male Photinus firefly. And when the male Photinus firefly shows up, the Photurus female eats it, kills it, and eats it. And in doing so, she gains that chemical protection that the Photinus firefly carries. And that makes her, even the eggs that she will then lay, will be protected chemically, and her offspring will taste bitter to birds, and it will reduce the number of offspring that are eaten. So this, I don't know if it's a competition. It certainly is a sort of a diabolical way to gain some defense against your enemies. But the Photinus and Photurus fireflies are at battle all the time out there, and they have adapted some pretty interesting strategies in this war against their predators. That's the Phenology Show for this week. Get out and enjoy the fireflies, because they are only going to be here for another month or so, and then they will be gone until next year. And they provide a great deal of entertainment for some of us young at heart and for some of the young. I had my 3-year-old grandson out running around after dragon or after fireflies one night when he didn't fall asleep. It's a great sport. That's the Phenology Show for this week. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back again next week and do it all again.
You'll be able to find this week's Phenology Report at our website later this week, kaxc.org. It is the Tuesday morning show. I'm Jennifer Barr with John Latimer. It is 7:43. Coming up about 1 hour from now, we are going to talk with Dr. Daniel Larkin, a professor and extension specialist with the University of Minnesota. He is going to be talking about the starry stonewort, and he'll be leading the Practical Water Wisdom webinar series that Itasca Waters does every month this Thursday. So we'll be learning more about that coming up. And 9 o'clock, Headwaters with Kari Headland. Programming on KAXE, KBXE is supported in part by the Minnesota Board on Aging's Legal Kiosks, offering no-charge assistance with housing benefits, custody, and more. Legal Kiosk, located in libraries and local trusted community spaces, connect Minnesotans with legal information and virtual meeting access. In some locations, court forms can be printed at no cost. Help is available in many languages. More online at legalkiosks.org.
Support for KEXE comes from the Great Lakes Aquarium, celebrating 25 years of bringing aquatic life and learning to Duluth, Minnesota, with ocean and freshwater-focused exhibits for visitors of all ages. Hours and tickets at glaquarium.org.
It is time now for best wishes. We're going to do our best to wish our friends and neighbors happy birthday, happy anniversary. We have arrived at July 8th.
Yeah, and boy, so have a lot of other people. Lots of birthday parties. You shouldn't have trouble finding somebody celebrating their birthday today. We have Axel Ross, who is 35 today. Tim McMullen, who is 47. Tim is from Grand Rapids. My friend Bruce Bartos is having a birthday today in Grand Rapids. My sister Sally is having her birthday today in Minneapolis. And we got Charlie Peterson, who is 73 and having his birthday today in Swatara. Bonnie Heinecker is 65 today, and Bonnie lives in Pine River. Sarah Kranak is 48 today, and it is her birthday, and she is from Severna Park, Maryland. So it says here she's
the sister of our volunteer Back Porch Harmony host, Jen Buey.
Ah, okay. Very good. And my good friend and a phenologist par excellence and a wonderful fourth grade teacher over in Duluth, Rob Marone, is celebrating his 56th birthday today. Happy birthday, Rob. Happy birthday, Sally, Axel, Tim, Bruce, Charlie, Bonnie, Sarah, and Rob, as I already mentioned. Have a nice birthday today.
Hope you all have a great day. If you have birthday or anniversary greetings to share, you can text us 218-326-1234. We're going to hear some music now from Margot Price. She will be part of this year's Grand Rapids River Fest, Saturday, September 6th, along with Courtney Barnett, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. You can find tickets and more information on that event, GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. Here is Margot Price. The song's called Light Me Up.
Dreams have left me so uptight. If the world turns out your light, honey, it will always be alright. Right, be alright.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Some of the country's leading medical groups representing doctors and others in public health are suing Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
The lawsuit is focused on some of his recent actions on vaccine policy. It alleges that Kennedy's decisions on COVID vaccines has endangered the public and violated federal law.
NPR health correspondent Will Stone joins me now to explain. Hi, Will.
Hi there.
Okay, so tell us more about the specifics here. Who's bringing this lawsuit, and why do they think Kennedy has acted illegally?
Yeah, there are six medical groups who are filing suit, including the American College of Physicians, the American Public Health Association. There's also the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Susan Kresley leads that organization, and here's what she told reporters on Monday.
Over the past several months, experts have been sidelined, evidence has been undermined, and our nation's vaccine infrastructure is now threatened.
So this is a 42-page complaint. It catalogs many of Kennedy's actions and statements on vaccines since he became head of the Department of Health and Human Services. It argues he's demonstrated a, quote, clear pattern of hostility toward the established scientific process and installed people with anti-vaccine views in positions of authority. All of that is the context for what the lawsuit actually centers on, which is Kennedy's specific decision related to the COVID vaccine schedule. In late May, people may remember, Kennedy announced the federal government was removing the CDC recommendations that pregnant women and healthy children should get the shots. And that's really what this lawsuit is focused on.
Okay, so what is the argument that that was illegal?
Yeah, I mean, the groups say this was arbitrary and capricious and violated how these decisions should be made under federal law. Yes, Kennedy is the head of HHS and does oversee the CDC, but there are still procedures in place that Congress has outlined. For example, changes to the CDC vaccine schedule are supposed to involve a federal panel of experts that give advice on vaccines. The lawsuit says Kennedy bypassed the normal process. He did not consult with this expert group, that he did not explain why he was going against the evidence that supports vaccinating children and pregnant women. It also points out Kennedy later went on to replace this panel of experts entirely with his own choices. So those are just some of the points these medical groups are making to back up their complaint. And one of the plaintiffs is actually a pregnant physician who is remaining anonymous, but says she fears she won't be able to get a COVID shot as a result of Kennedy's directive.
And what's the reaction been like to this lawsuit? Does it have a chance?
Well, obviously, Kennedy's efforts to overhaul vaccine policy have been front and center during his tenure, you know, very controversial and concerning to many in public health. This lawsuit touches on all of that, but James Hodge, who's a health law professor at ASU, told me it's not enough to just talk about undermining trust in vaccines. It comes down to some technical questions about administrative law and whether he disregarded the process.
You've got to actually prove that the secretary went outside the boundaries of the law and instituted policy without following proper procedure. They make a plausible case that that's occurred here, Will, and to that degree, I think a court will at least entertain some of that.
Now, in response to the lawsuit, an HHS spokesperson sent a brief statement to NPR saying the secretary stands by his CDC reforms. The lawyer representing these medical societies said they hope to get a hearing scheduled in the next few weeks. Ultimately, their goal is to restore the original recommendations for children and pregnant women to get the COVID shots.
NPR's Will Stone. Thank you, Will.
Thank you.
President Trump's immigration crackdown has frightened many recent immigrants who are now holding on to their money. That is crushing small businesses in some areas where a lot of immigrants live. Frank Morris of member station KCUR has this report.
Immigrants without legal status wield an enormous amount of buying power. The American Immigration Council says in 2023 it totaled nearly $300 billion. The money is often spent at stores along streets like Central Avenue in Kansas City, Kansas. Lucy Angel opened a party store on this street, hoping to cash in on the traffic she saw last year. But she says that this year the traffic died way down.
We saw it was a busy place. But right now, it's just not like we saw it. Central Avenue is really slow.
She blames President Trump's deportation drive for chilling this Hispanic business corridor.
Yeah, you can feel it. And hopefully, they're going to start making their parties. But no, they're not making anything.
A slowdown in immigrant spending is a big problem for Kansas City, Kansas. The city's more than a third Hispanic, many of them foreign-born. It also attracts immigrants from Asia, Africa. Edgar Galicia, who directs the Central Area Betterment Association, says shops and restaurants on Central Avenue tell him business is off 30 to 60%.
All of them have reported lost in sales because once the witch hunt started, everybody's afraid. Nobody wants to come out.
And when shoppers do go out, they're often confronted with higher prices because many of the things recent immigrants buy are products imported from their home countries.
Right now, we feel attacked because not only are they going after our people, they increase our prices.
And it's not just Kansas City, Kansas.
From New York to LA, from the state of Washington to Florida, up north, down south, everywhere is happening.
Big companies like Coca-Cola and Constellation Brands report that their Hispanic customers are withholding some of their $2 trillion in spending power. And Latinos aren't the only immigrant group affected. At Jay's Grocery in Kansas City, Missouri, already Jay sells primarily to immigrants from Central Africa. He's watched his sales plummet by half this year because his customers are nervous and his prices have spiked.
American first policies, like the tariff, is impacting our business negatively for sure. Since, especially me as an immigrant, as a refugee, we import a lot of food abroad.
A throw pillow-sized bag of dried sardines imported from Tanzania used to retail for $25. Now it's $35. And bad as things are now for some immigrant businesses, they may be about to get much worse. Eric Rodriguez with UNITAS U.S. says President Trump's mass deportation drive is just ramping up.
The government immigration enforcement agencies still don't have the resources they need to do it on the scale that they propose to do it. That's coming.
The Republican tax and spending bill signed by President Trump last week includes as much as $170 billion for deportation operations. All that spending is likely to stoke more fear, keeping workers and shoppers at home and further starving mom-and-pop businesses. Edgar Galicia says the new tariffs make matters worse.
So it's this whole bunch of things happening that are destroying our way of life, destroying the stability we have built on our own, destroying the lifelong investment that has been put into this place.
Galicia worries the immigration crackdown will wreck decades of steady progress on Central Avenue. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City, Kansas.
This is NPR News.
This is KAXE in the Tuesday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr, sitting in for Heidi Holton today with John Latimer. Good morning.
Good morning. We receive support from the U of M Extension Forestry, hosting a Minnesota Woodland Steward Program in Itasca County to help develop a deeper understanding of forest stewardship and manage fire risk. Registration open until August 10th with a discount for Itasca County land.